Der Marketing Transformation Podcast mit Erik Siegmann.
Herzlich willkommen zu einer neuen Folge des Marketing Transformation Podcast. Heute mit einer ganz großen Besonderheit, denn heute werden wir diese Folge auf Englisch machen. Welcome, Sascha Schmitz from Mighty Hive.
Thanks, Eric. Nice to be here.
It's a pleasure. I think hardly anyone else has moved the world of traditional media agencies more than you and Mighty Hive. So I'm really looking forward for our discussion. Thanks for taking the time. And thanks for my audience, or at least I need to excuse myself. We're doing that in English. My English is probably not as good as my German. Who knows? But thanks for taking the time. I think Mighty Hive, you are going to explain in a second. I think Mighty Hive is well known in the German market as a member of the S4 Capital Group. The capital S4 Capital Group of the legendary Sir Martin Sorrell. I think most certainly one of the most interesting player on the international landscape between media, data, and brands. But before we dive into Mighty Hive and your experience, Sascha, please tell us a little bit about yourself, please.
Great. Thanks, Eric. Great to be here, and thank you for setting this up. I think my English is probably better than my German, so I appreciate it. Although I do come originally from Switzerland, but I grew up in the States. So a little bit about myself. My name is Sascha Schmitz. I am the managing director for Mighty Hive in EMEA. I am based in London. I'm actually originally from San Francisco, so I'm one of the very few people who was born and bred in San Francisco, grew up in the city while Silicon Valley was booming. Mm-hmm. And then about 4 years ago, I moved to London and opened the Mighty Hive office in the UK. And over the past few years, obviously, we've been opening offices across the region and just opened in Germany. So
excellent. Yeah, let's get right into it. So Mighty Hive, I get a lot of questions about Mighty Hive. So what is Mighty Hive? Is that a media agency? Is it a consultancy? Is it a tech implementator? How would you describe Mighty Hive?
Yeah, it's a great question. So we see Mighty Hive as the digital transformation partner that sort of combines the capabilities of a consultancy with the media knowledge of an agency, and actually expertise in cloud and ad tech platforms as well. So we're sort of the nexus between technology, media, and consultancy. And we first were born in 2012 as a Google marketing platform. And at that time, it was called DoubleClick Reseller. And so we built our business around being sort of an expert in the DoubleClick technology and partnering really closely with Google and basically being a sounding board for them as they, you know, built out the ad tech platform for the marketers. And then over the past couple of years, we obviously moved a little bit upstream as well into more of a consultancy space as well, because we basically saw a trend in the market that brands were asking for support in undergoing a digital transformation. So that can be anything from in-housing to building out data, first party data roadmaps, understanding how to integrate different ad tech and martech platforms. And then finally, in 2018, we actually merged with S4 Capital, Sir Martin Sorrell's new venture. And it's interesting, I think, here to call out is that it wasn't an acquisition. We specifically call it a merger because we were really trying to build out a group of organizations and companies where the leadership actually remains in place and can help drive forward sort of the agenda of the new organization. And so we brought our media capabilities, our tech capabilities, and our data capabilities and combined them with MediaMonks, which is the creative partner within S4 Capital. And they're the sort of cool kids. We're the nerds.
Yeah, and even if you, well, you consider yourself as the nerds, but you are the challengers to a specific market itself, aren't you? Well, there was a lot that was really interesting, but there that raises a lot of questions from my observation. Like, you originally came from a pretty close to Google's tech setup, operational implementation partner side. Maybe before we discuss your positioning within the existing and probably the new market, let's dive into the main drivers of your existence. That probably, as you already said, that is the digital transformation, specifically in media. How would you describe the importance and the consequences from the advertiser's point of view in media transformation?
Yeah, I think it's a great question, Eric. So I think what we sort of have seen around media transformation and digital transformation is that clients are really wanting more transparency and control into how they're doing things. And this is ultimately what we were trying to do, is help our clients take control. Technology has sort of democratized media buying for all marketers, and marketers really want to understand how to take control of their tech, upskill their teams to become technology experts, and use data to its fullest potential. And so this is sort of something that we recognize is happening, and something that we really wanted to fulfill for our brands. In terms of what the importance and the consequences for advertisers, I think transformation is not change for the sake of change or to keep up with the latest buzzwords. I think this is oftentimes something that we see is that, you know, in-housing a few years ago was this sort of this term that everybody was excited about. Brands were doing it just because it was trendy, right? But I think it should really be looking at how can it accelerate growth and sustainability for the brand, and how can it really accelerate the connection between the brand and the consumer. Right now we're seeing that the internet and the digitalization of all aspects of consumer experience are driving a need for media transformation for all marketers. And I think this digitalization and the fact that everything is sort of moving online is really the... It is a trend, but I think it's here to stay. So we've sort of seen the impact of that through COVID as well, right? So we've seen that in the US, for example, retailers that did not have a strong digital commerce capability or were already struggling with the shift to digital are part of a wave of pandemic bankruptcies. And I know that this is something that many markets across EMEA are insulating the industry against, but in the US, bankruptcies are sort of, you know, running rampant right now. So Neiman Marcus, which is a high-end retailer, Brooks Brothers, which is sort of the staple of the men's retail space, and then also Guitar Center, which is the biggest musical instrument retailer in the US, have all filed for bankruptcy in 2020. And the main reason for this is just because they weren't able to adapt to the fact that, you know, commerce was now happening online. And it's funny because I think Guitar Center, for example, this should have been a perfect fit for them because, you know, so many people were taking up new hobbies during the pandemic. And, you know, my husband, for example, he bought a guitar. And so he probably would have been a perfect consumer for Guitar Center, and yet they weren't able to adapt. So now that consumers are more used to shopping and being entertained and communicating online, companies really must adapt.
Sasha, I'm wondering whether you would agree on the thesis that brands are right now more affected by the media transformation more than compared to direct-to-consumer advertisers, because this new reality in direct-to-consumer was there longer before, and the need was already existing. The need we feel right now because of COVID or because of more competition or because we can't reach our targeted audiences anymore to the same extent as we could do it in the old TV and print-driven media markets. Isn't the need for digital transformation on the brand, or let's say on the non-direct-to-consumer brands, even bigger than other verticals, for instance?
Yeah, actually, that's a great call out, 100%. So I think we can definitely talk about direct to consumer and retail till the cows come home. That's my American phrase right there. But I think you're right. Like by 2024, 70% of the market is going to be digital. And so I think it's important that branding plays are going to be done in the digital space as well. And I think this is actually where it's really interesting to talk about content and creative, right? So, it's not only about data and digital media. I think marketers have to be fluent in the intersection of people, technology, and culture. And this also requires high quality, fit for format content. So content that is fit for market, fit for the specific audience, and fit for the specific platform. So TikTok, for example, is on the rise, right? And so I think if we want to start building content that's going to connect with a brand and not necessarily entice or it's going to connect with a consumer and not necessarily entice a consumer to buy, but just, you know, build a relationship with that consumer, that content needs to be tailored to the right audience. And so I think the way to tailor that content is by, you know, leveraging first party data. And so this is where the need to really understand how the consumer is interacting across different touch points with your brand is critical to just build a relevant story that a consumer will connect with.
I get a sense of that. Could you help me in describing, according to your experience, what the most important steps for this transformation on the advertiser sides are, and maybe you could give some examples of maybe common mistakes you're observing regarding the initiatives or the priorities you see on your clients or other industry participants side of you. What are the most important steps and what are the most common mistakes to avoid?
Yeah, for sure. So I think transformation, I think oftentimes companies often think it's a long, tedious process. Mm-hmm. And yes, it does require investment and time. But I think that there are also quick wins that can be achieved. So let's talk about data, for example. If you're building a first-party data strategy, which is oftentimes the thing that we're really focused on, is, you know, there's quick wins that can be achieved. So internalizing the ad tech contracts that a brand may have. So brands are starting to move away from buying media on the agency contracts and now starting to build relationships or direct contracting relationships with the vendor. So, you know, Reckitt Benckiser, for example, they decided to move away from buying media on the agency contract and move to directly buying on either a Google platform, which they contract with Google, or with a reseller model, for example, where you're basically an extension of Google. And so I think these are some of the things that you can do relatively quickly. It takes maybe 3 to 6 months to internalize contracts. And once you do that, the brand owns the data. Yeah. However, I think sometimes the biggest deterrent here is actually going to be the rigmarole of a procurement process. So I think this is actually an interesting learning that we've sort of seen as well, is that procurement teams need to start to adapt their tender process and the documents that they're requiring agencies or vendors to fill out. So a procurement team should no longer be asking for the price of every single ad serving format, publisher rate, et cetera, when the discussion is focused on internalizing the tech contract or consolidating buying on a DSP, right? So it should, I think there's actually an opportunity here for not only to transform our marketing departments, but also transform our procurement departments. Yeah.
Sasha, this is a great example. I would like to dive a little bit deeper into it because I think it's a very, on an operational and organizational level, it's extremely, well, obvious where the friction points are. Mm-hmm. Let me first start with the point, like you said, okay, direct vendor relationship, direct access to at the source, Google, compared to a system where the media agency is the holder of the contract and sitting on the data. the typical argument on this level could be it's absolutely no problem. We as an agent, we as a traditional media agency, we're providing you, advertiser, all the data you might need. We're giving you kind of full access to our dashboards, and you can see almost everything you could see on a direct basis to a, for instance, Google system. What would be your argument?
Yeah, so I think it's a really good question. And I think there's a couple things to consider here. I think there's a benefit in owning the data to actually have complete transparency and control over things, to really be able to audit and validate that all of the information is correct. And I actually don't think that agencies are really trying to lie or anything like that. I think there is truthfulness, but I think there's a question around speed and agility, right? So if a brand wants to have insights, you know, by the afternoon, they shouldn't have to email the agency and ask for the dashboard to be updated, right? There's an opportunity here to actually just, you know, build an internal team or to have access to the data and for the team to be able to just, you know, pull a report whenever they want to. Because oftentimes, even if the agency gives access to the data, that doesn't necessarily mean that the brand is logging into the platform and pulling reports themselves, right?
Yeah.
I think the other
and it's not automated in any kind. So it's got limitations on the granularity of the data. And you already mentioned speed and agility.
Yes, absolutely. And I think the other thing is flexibility. So, you know, if, for example, the brand decided to move away from that agency, then technically, the ownership of that data sits with the agency. And if the brand were to move to a new partner, they wouldn't necessarily be able to take that data with them. They wouldn't necessarily be able to take that campaign setup with them. And all of the dashboards wouldn't go with them to the new partner that they would choose, right? Mm-hmm. So I think there's an opportunity not only for speed, agility, and transparency, but also for transition and scalability if you know, new partners were to be introduced, or if, you know, a new tendering process were to begin.
Yeah. Okay. I do get it. And now to the second part of your great example, the advertiser internal procurement process. Like I like the picture you said. We don't need any item lines on quotes performed per channel. I think the RFP processes in many of the traditional advertisers are still designed to fit to like TV and print advertising. Where do you see the best argument to make these changes on the procurement side? Because, well, in many companies, procurement and marketing don't understand each other as they could or should. Don't you?
Yeah.
Don't they?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I think this actually kind of has to be changed from the top, right? And I think this is oftentimes where we actually see an opportunity to do change management with the CMO or even the CTO, for example. It's challenging because the CMO often sees things short term. Like the average tenure of a CMO right now is, you know, 40 months. It's just over 3 years. So it's difficult for them to.
It's 3 years in which markets? Is that a US or a European figure?
This is actually predominantly a US figure, but I think it's, you know, we're probably going to see relatively similar trends in around the world. And it's difficult to make sweeping changes or to achieve transformation during that short time. But there is a significant argument to be made that this change needs to start at the top, so that CMO and that CTO, for example, or even the CEO can decide that building a digital first data literate team is going to be the agenda of the organization, and that extends to procurement as well. And I think this is where we really need to build, or we really need to socialize and educate our teams, or maybe even appoint digital champions internally so that the organization can start to learn, because oftentimes it's just a issue around education and understanding, right? And then finally, I think we need the leadership of organizations to build out the right incentive structures. So, you know, making sure that teams understand that if we're doing data standardization project around the globe that will ultimately give us clean data that we can then compare apples to apples, that all of the global teams understand and all the regional teams understand the value of that project, and that procurement understands the value of that project. Yeah. So I think it comes down to education, but that kind of has to start at the top.
Yeah, I get it. How do you, out of curiosity, how do you avoid conflict of interest? Like you said, there's a need of education. It's at the top. You are acting, of course, as a professional service supplier, as a partially a vendor of a tech solution, and as a consultancy. How do you avoid conflict of interest?
Yeah, it's a great question. So we see ourselves much more as sort of an advisory and governance partner than we see ourselves as an execution partner. We, at the end of the day, what we're trying to do, like I mentioned, Eric, was help brands take control, right? Mm-hmm. So I think this is sort of, this is part of that narrative. We can certainly execute media for a brand, but it's with the intent of helping them understand how that media is running, teaching them as we go what makes sense. And then if they ultimately want to in-house the media, then they can do so. And then same with the tech platform. We don't see this as our primary line of business. We see it much more as sort of a solution that, again, enables control and transparency and the things that we espouse.
Mm-hmm. Okay, get it. How, before we dive into the question around insourcing and insourcing, in-housing, are there any other examples, like common mistakes to avoid, or maybe there are some common mistakes and or important positive transformational steps when thinking and starting an insourcing or in-housing process? Maybe if you don't mind, maybe you could give us some examples why in-housing is getting traction, or if in-housing is still getting traction, because in the direct-to-consumer industry, this is more or less common sense for many of the media types. What's the trend of in-housing right now?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. So I think we sort of see in-housing actually along a spectrum of control. So on the one hand, on the one end of the spectrum, we have completely outsourced in transparent models. And on the other end of the spectrum, a brand has insourced their data, their contracts, their media operations, their governance, right? Mm-hmm. But I think a lot of brands sort of are moving along that spectrum of control. And so with the rise of privacy regulations and the need to build first-party audiences and data reserves, data and tech in housing is something that most brands are seeing now as critical. And so owning those tech contracts, owning dashboarding solutions, and owning first-party data is critical. And that's along that spectrum is where that's sort of where most of the brands have already gone. The next piece is operations and people in housing. And I think the motivations for in-housing media buying operations should actually be very carefully considered. And I think our organization is often seen as the in-housing partner, but we're not actually going to recommend in-housing for a brand unless it really makes sense for them. Yeah. And this is where things like cost or it being the ultimate ambition may not be the right choice if cost is the main motivator. Since what we've often seen actually is that brands in-house media buying operations in an effort to bring down costs. However, what we've seen is that you may save, 10-20% during the first 2 years, but then, the board is still going to say, okay, next year you need to save another 10-15-20%. The next year you need to save another 10-15-20%. And suddenly the in-house team is no longer viable, and the recommendation from the board is to say, okay, go back to a media agency, right?
Yeah.
And so I think this is where the motivations for in-housing operations needs to be carefully considered.
If I might interrupt.
Yeah.
So you're saying a cost motivation is a false friend, isn't it? It's a purely cost-driven motivation to insource these functions.
I believe it is. Yeah.
Yeah. Me too. I know that it can be an easy shortcut if you don't have enough airtime to your CFO, or whatever, to have this line of argumentation that it's bringing costs down, and everyone, well, nobody likes agency fees. They might not even understand where they're coming from.
Yeah.
But I think the complexity of the digital media environment is probably one of the drivers to have more effort to steer and to manage the buying and this iterational process. But according to my experience, I've never seen costs coming down.
Yeah, exactly. Right. I think that's exactly right, Eric. I think it cost can be, you know, maybe one motivator, but I think it needs to be considered with other key functions, like you said. I think transparency is a big thing that a lot of brands are asking for. Brand protection. You know, I think this is another one. If the brand believes, listen, we know our brand better than an agency is ever going to know our brand, then that's probably a good reason to consider in-housing operations, because, you know, the team will live and breathe that brand identity.
Yeah, absolutely. And cost isn't equal efficiency, isn't it?
Right.
So it's, and cost of steering isn't cost of media. But I think we both agree. But I think this message I think the gap between traditional advertisers and mostly in the non-direct to consumer business are still too much focused on the cost argumentation, and that leads, like you said, that doesn't lead us anywhere.
Yeah.
Okay. You said, okay, if you're looking at insourcing opportunities, you're looking at the main motivators. What are the other necessary circumstances which needs to be met on the advertiser's part of it that you're recommending an insourcing process?
It's a great question. I think again, it sort of depends on what we're insourcing, right? So if we're insourcing everything, so tech contracts where, you know, we want to own our data and we're also insourcing operations, then it's really important for brands to have the infrastructure and the process able to support this. And I think this is not only about the marketing team, but it also goes back to procurement, and it also goes back to finance. And this is an interesting piece. When insourcing contracts, for example, I think a lot of brands don't recognize what a lift it is suddenly going to be for the finance team to support paying, invoices to a tech vendor, for example, country by country, rather than having an agency, you know, send an invoice which couples media services plus tech costs without sort of that level of detail. So I think the finance teams need to be briefed to be able to support this. And then again, on the sort of on a process piece, it's really important that there is a robust system of governance in place. So the need to be able to make sure that there is a following of a standard taxonomy is going to be critical. And I think this is relevant for insourced operations, but also if you're working with an agency, because at the end of the day, we want to be able to have clean data to make decision making. And so we not only need to think about the people who are going to be executing the media and collecting the data, but we also need to make sure that there is a team or some sort of a person potentially in place that's validating that what we're doing is following sort of the best practices or golden rules that are set up, right?
Yeah.
Additionally, I think it's really important to have some sort of a system of constant learning and exposure to trends that are happening in the industry, because I think this is often what we see as well, is brands are worried about insourcing because they're worried that their teams are no longer going to be exposed to different ideas, to new trends, to new platforms. And so having some sort of a continuous learning and development program in place is going to be important, not only for, being on top of the industry topics, but also to make sure that your teams feel fulfilled and that, you know, you can retain your team. Since investing in an in-house team is time consuming and costly, and you don't want them leaving after a year and a half.
Yeah, absolutely. So I understood the complexity, the necessity of getting more control and transparency in that process, that was really interesting. All you said was really interesting, but the point I haven't seen so far was that also the further need of complying to privacy regulations is also a driver, even for the brand industry, to get this kind of transparent ownership into the process. I've been very efficiency focused, but of course, regulation is also a very important, crucial point. Mm-hmm. How do you see the role of creation and like creative? Like you mentioned, Media Monks. My understanding is that, well, due to the changes in the programmatic world, creation or the importance of creation has been completely redefined. Where do you see opportunities and challenges today at the intersection of data, tech, and creation?
Yeah, I think this is an interesting one. I think it actually goes back to people and process more than sort of like technology and data. Mm-hmm. I think the fundamental shift that we're seeing is that brands are starting to realize the need to de-silo the teams that are looking after content and creative, the teams that are looking after data, and the teams that are looking after media. Mm-hmm. And I think this is sort of a legacy challenge that was created from, you know, when the holdcos really started to build up their businesses, where, you know, building out siloed teams in order to drive efficiency and bring down cost was the model of the time. But now what we really want to see is that the silos are brought down. We want to see mm-hmm. these teams sitting side by side. And we actually see that there's a lot of value in cross-training, even to a small extent, these teams across the different capabilities. So, you know, our teams, for example, we have a media team, we have a data team, and we have a content team. And by just improving sort of the data literacy of the content team and the creative literacy of the media and data teams has been amazing in terms of just the ability to move quicker and to have meaningful conversations around what mm-hmm. needs to happen for the client. And I think this is also going to be possible on the brand side as well, is to bring these teams into some sort of a center of excellence where they can exchange ideas and learn from one another. It kind of boils down to one concept. So to get consistent growth, you have to understand consumers. And it's important for marketers to know this, that there's no source of truth to get there. But by analyzing multiple data points to see what our audience is engaging with and through more efficient adaptive production processes, we can be better at applying learnings to deliver effective content at record speeds. But the only way to do that is to make sure that the content teams understand the data. So one of the things that we're doing right now actually is we have an econometrics team that is building out these amazing media mix models. And the outcome of the media mix model, which basically is telling us, you know, which channel, be it digital, be it television, be it influencers, is going to drive the highest ROI. These insights are then being given to the content teams to build better content, and are given to the media teams to adapt where the media investment is happening. And then is also given to the data analytics team to understand, are we really tracking properly the data that's coming through this channel? So I think the opportunity to basically have these teams sit side by side is going to be the change maker.
Yeah, interesting. Really interesting. And also, I think it's pretty obvious, if I'm listening to you, that the org and people part is a crucial factor, and that tech analytics and automation is following that. Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Yeah, great. How do you are, I think it's extremely interesting to have the opportunity to discuss with you also the different levels of maturity. Like, you've seen you're still involved with the US and of course mainly with the international European markets. I don't know how much you already what your impression on the German market is. But could you describe a little bit the potential differences in levels of maturity from the advertisers, or maybe also from the competition part of you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think this is kind of fun because I have worked in the US and then I've also mm-hmm. worked in EMEA, and I've sort of seen the changes. In the US, we typically see many of these trends around sort of in-housing, data ownership, tech contract insourcing happen about 12 to 18 months ahead of the EMEA markets. Mm-hmm. And when we look at EMEA and sort of the traction that we're seeing in EMEA around these topics, the UK is often at the forefront of them.
The UK?
The UK, yeah. Mm-hmm. So I think they're often the first follower mm-hmm. of these things. Mm-hmm. That said, however, I think the challenge, of course, is that in EMEA, we have so many different markets, and mm-hmm. it's often difficult for an organization or a brand that may have operations in in half a dozen markets in EMEA to really mm-hmm. build the consensus to make a big change like this. The other thing that we're seeing is that I think there's just completely different cultural perspectives in how digital transformation needs to be addressed across markets. So, Eric, you and I were talking about this a couple of weeks ago when we first connected. But I think in Germany, for example, I think there is a longer decision-making process around pursuing digital transformation. Let's say data in-housing, for example. However, once that decision is made, then the brand goes after it full force, right?
Yeah.
So I think there's sort of a bit of a conservative decision-making process. However, once that decision has been arrived at, then there's no turning back. And I think that's something that we see a difference in US, for example, where it's a little bit more the wild, wild west.
Yeah.
They're keen to try different things, even at the risk of it not potentially working out. And I think that's a cultural difference between different markets.
Yeah. Interesting. If you would compare the UK to the US, where would you see the biggest differences?
Yeah, I think in the UK, I think there is a little bit more of a... there's a little bit more thought put into the decision as well. But I think the other challenge is that this is symptomatic of every market in EMEA. The market is smaller, and therefore the budgets are smaller. And since budgets are smaller, the volume may not exist to actually have the use case or the reason to insource something necessarily, right? So mm-hmm. I think the need to build out a more robust use case in the UK exists as well, just mm-hmm. because it's not necessarily going to make sense to in-house operations or even in-house media. Whereas in the US, I think it's often a little bit more easy to make that decision because the use case is a little bit more black and white. But I guess on the flip side, you could say also that because the volumes are so great in America, the risk of failure is greater.
Yeah. I get it. I think what really strikes me when I look at the UK is the level of competition mm-hmm. from on the advertisers and on the tech and agency side. And that, from my understanding, that drives a certain need for efficiency in efficiency coming by. Well, the level of execution, the quality of execution, but also the quality of the setup on all the sides. And I think that's something we observe on the German market as well. But I totally can relate to your observation that sometimes it really takes time till a decision is made. But once we set course, we keep the course, maybe even too long. But I think that's a very common observation. What's your take on how do you see the broader media agency landscape in Europe? What's your prediction for the next 5 and 10 years? Are we going to see more consultancies going into them? media environment, more tech players? How are the networks, media industry developing further? What's your vision on the media industry landscape?
Yeah, sure. It's a great question. And don't hold me to these things in 2 years.
I won't. But it will be interesting to follow up, but go ahead.
Yeah, sure. So I think the agency landscape can sort of broadly be divided into three categories. So there's the indies, mm-hmm. there's the holdcos, and then there's the consultancies.
Sorry, you need to explain that. The independents?
Yeah.
The independent media agencies, so that they don't belong to a media network?
That's
the
right.
Others?
So the independent media agencies that don't belong to one of the, mm-hmm. the networks or the holding companies. Mm-hmm. Then there's the holding companies, which, you know, mm-hmm. there's the five or six large ones. And then there's the consultancies. So mm-hmm. Sort of the
Deloitte's, Accenture's,
BCG's, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right.
Mm-hmm. So the way the agency landscape evolves is sort of highly dependent on how other actors are evolving, be them clients on one end or publishers on the other, right? So clients are likely to start moving more and more services in-house, mm-hmm. whereas publishers will likely curate their content more and more on the individual needs, right? The right mm-hmm. content on the right channel for me. Mm-hmm. And furthermore, there will be an abundance of channels as new players will enter the marketplace. And it's unlikely that consolidation between FANGs is to be expected. And FANGs is the biggest companies out there. So Facebook, Amazon, mm-hmm. Apple, Netflix, Google. Mm-hmm. So I don't think we're going to see a consolidation among that. So those are going to be the main players out there. Mm-hmm. And this is kind of, this will leave us with a very scattered sort of publisher marketplace mm-hmm. with loads of available technology and advertisers not really being able to take every channel in-house necessarily. Mm-hmm. So while I think clients want to move things in-house, I think there will still be the need for, you know, outsourced specialties. Mm-hmm. So with that in mind, I think the agency landscape will most likely evolve sort of with the following ideas in mind. So independent, these are sort of the non-holding company agencies, right? So full service mm-hmm. indie agencies are probably going to become more and more a road less traveled. So there's just too many channels to be really good at everything. So mm-hmm. I think what we're going to see is that there's going to be a move towards more specialized agencies delivering deep knowledge on specific channels. So mm-hmm. an Amazon agency, for example, or a YouTube agency, et cetera. And in-house teams are going to likely tender deeply ingrained specialist knowledge more easily mm-hmm. since the more commoditized channels are going to be able to be managed in-house. So
yeah.
we're going to see the brands going for these specialized services while trying to in-house maybe something like, you know, paid search.
You're saying the more commoditized a channel gets, probably it's also rule-based, a certain level of maturity, then it's more likely to be in-house, and the specialty agency or the agencies specialized in other channels might be the new kids on the block where the level of maturity and the level of innovation is still pretty high, isn't it?
Yes, you said it better than I did.
Okay, right. I'm just trying to comprehend and to make sure that I understood you right.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah. No, that's exactly right. But it's interesting because I think these deeply specialized agencies are going to be easier takeover targets for mm-hmm. private equity funded buy and build companies as well, mm-hmm. right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure.
Then sort of the second one is the holding companies or the networks. So I think the holding companies, they sort of struggle with legacy infrastructure on offline buying. So, mm-hmm. you know, offline's declining 2-3% a year right now, but that's not necessarily reflected in their headcount dedicated towards offline. Mm-hmm. So the legacy infrastructure is exactly what they need to sort of start to address. They're going to need to really understand how to shift their teams to being more digitally focused, since this is where we're seeing the growth. Mm-hmm. And I think that the biggest shift that we will see in the next year is that holdcos will undoubtedly vertically integrate if they haven't already. So not only are they going to need to shift some of their team structure from being sort of this legacy offline, but they're also going to need to look at the different agencies that they have within their holding company. So Publicis, for example, and Wandentsu are examples of holding companies that are ditching sort of a label strategy for the greater benefit. So I think within 5 to 10 years, IPG's media and creative labels will have fully merged, which means that Universal Media and McCann World Group will become one. And I guess I could say one again.
Okay. Is if I think about it, like legacy issues, a vertical development, that is costly, and that's a transformation on the service supplier side. And probably, well, that comes with certain friction because, well, it's not only on the agency, on the holding company side, it's also on their mainly brand advertiser side as well. On the other hand, the complexity and the operational margin is going to shrink, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Isn't that a dilemma? How would you solve that dilemma if you would be responsible on the holding company side?
I mean, I think it's sort of the same thing that I would tell a brand, is that you need to take a bit of a long-term view in terms of organizationally redesigning your team, right? So the team is the organization is going to have to focus inward instead of focusing on clients for maybe, you know, a good 18 months, which is going to be a real problem for the bottom line and for the operational margin. But it's probably necessary if they want to remain competitive with both the drive towards in-housing, the rise of the into agencies, and then the last one as well, which is the consultancies.
Yeah.
And I know we only have a couple minutes left, so I'll...
No problem. This is we have all the time of the world. This is extremely interesting. Go ahead.
Okay. So I think the consultancies are also a really, really interesting one. So I think core elements of the consultancies have moved beyond just delivering a PDF from quite a while ago. So consultancies are obviously excellent in M&A strategy, compliance, and most of them are pretty decent systems integrators as well. For marketing services, however, they just don't seem to be agile enough to serve advertisers the way agencies do. And I should say, yet.
Yeah. Why is that? What do you think? Is it also a legacy issue from the tech side of things? Or where is that coming from?
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I think it comes from the fact that, you know, I think consultancies are run incredibly well for the role that they were meant to serve, which was being sort of these long-term partners for brands that are looking to undergo transformation. And I shouldn't necessarily say marketing transformation. It's transformation around, you know, organizational redesign, tax, compliance, et cetera, right? Mm. Even like onboarding Salesforce can take, you know, 2 years, 2 to 3 years for an enterprise organization to do.
Yeah.
So I think what the consultancy isn't super strong at yet is being sort of that agile transformation partner to help brands do things swiftly and identify quick wins, right? And right now in the marketing services space, this is what brands are asking for, and this is what you know, organizations such as ours, for example, are able to deliver. So I think they're going to have to eliminate some of their red tape. They're going to have to rethink their process. And they're also going to have to build out the capabilities around media execution, data analytics, econometrics teams, et cetera. Because at the end of the day, they can't just give the roadmap. What brands want is not only someone to tell them what to do, but also to like guide them through that process, right? Mm. So,
and also to take, sorry to interrupt, but also to take some sort of operational accountability.
Absolutely. Exactly. Mm. Yeah. Mm. So I think it's likely that a consultancy will need to acquire a large agency, maybe even a holdco, right?
Mm-hmm.
Accenture is most likely the one to do that. They're already, you know, picking up smaller independent agencies here and there. And if you look at Accenture's market cap versus any holdco, then they could acquire a holdco on a Wednesday morning and still be doing something impactful by the afternoon.
Right. And they don't have a real margin issue because they still have pretty good margin on the tech side, don't they?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we're probably going to see, we're going to see Holdco's moving upstream into sort of more of a consultancy, vertically integrated strategy. And I think we're going to see consultancy move downstream into more of an execution space as well.
Mm-hmm. Really interesting. I don't know. Well, you're also a public listed company, or you're part of a public listed company. And I think, well, the capital markets, their speaker, a pretty clear language how the market expectations are per this vertical, especially holding companies and consultancies. Well, it's just an indicator. But that will be extremely interesting to follow up on mm-hmm. next couple of months or even years.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Sasha. This is really extremely interesting. Before I let you go, my final question. What was your best and your worst decision in the last 12 or 18 months?
This is a good one. My best decision, I got engaged. No, I'm kidding.
Oh, good. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank
How
you.
Do you know that is what? Wait, okay. Sorry. We'll find out.
Yeah. No, that's true. We'll see how it goes.
Congratulations. Yeah. Very good.
Thank you.
But you already were referring to your husband while citing that he was buying a guitar.
Yes, we had a... And not big. We just did the ceremony at City Hall because we're waiting for COVID to be over to have the big party.
Very good. Congratulations.
Thanks. I think the best decision we've probably made, it all relates to COVID, right? So I think the best decision is we're really trying to look after our teams. At the end of the day, marketing services, we're a people business. So we need to make sure that our people are happy and healthy. Mm-hmm. So we did a couple of things. To sort of relieve the stress of COVID. So we instituted COVID Relief Fridays where people can take off on every other Friday if they want. Mm-hmm. We're flexible where people can spend their time during lockdown. I think the return to the traditional work environment is never going to happen. I think we're always going to be more open to distributed teams and people working from where they want. Mm-hmm. And we're just trying to support more mental health initiatives. And I think I read this interesting article the other day, actually, that said that the way that brands or the way that companies are thinking about benefits and perks for their employees are no longer, a canteen at work or a gym membership or things like this. I think it's much more sort of these like people focused rather than commoditized focused benefits. So mental health support, the flexibility around working where you want to, letting people set their own hours. I think this is what people are going to ask for. And this is what we're trying to think about as well.
Yeah. Really interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. And then my worst decision.
What are the regrets?
Yeah. I mean, it's really interesting, Eric. And I think I almost feel like a little bit of a little silly saying this, but I think we tell brands to keep a long-term view, but it's so difficult to do that sometimes when, you need to hit your numbers and you want to make sure that you can show strong performance by the end of the year. So I think I was probably a little bit too conservative in how I thought about hiring and investing in my team. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting because I think we actually were one of the organizations that really benefited from the privacy regulation announcements because we were helping brands already set up a first party audience strategy, for example. Mm-hmm. But I wish I'd actually invested even more resources into this space. So that's something that I'm trying to do now is we're really trying to build up bigger teams, build capabilities, expand to new countries, et cetera.
Yeah, I totally get it. But that's understandable. Probably that was your first real crisis, your first pandemic.
Yeah, it was.
It wasn't my first crisis, but it was my first pandemic. And I totally get that. But like you said, I think you and your company, you are not only sitting on a pretty positive trend, you're also driving this trend. Thank you so much. For sharing all your insights and your experience. That was really interesting. My highlight of the week, so to say. and I'm looking forward to continue our discussion. And so I wish wish you all the best and hope to talk to you soon. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me, Eric. It was a pleasure.
Thanks, Sasha. Bye-bye. Bye.
Dieser Podcast wird produziert von Podstars bei OMR.